Accession number 23848, Real One.
Mr. Wild Gust, Real One. Right, Mr. Wild Gust, could you tell us your full name?
It's Neville Parker Wild Gust. I was born in Leicester on the 5th of August, 1922. Had three elder sisters. I found out later that I was the only son.
And what did your father do?
My father was a commercial traveller. He had served in the First World War, but not as a combatant. And he tended to be a bit of a pacifist. I remember at a very early age putting his Glengarry on and he'd take it off me and say, "You don't play soldiers with me," sort of thing, boy. My mother and he separated when I was about seven, but I still continued to see him sort of weekly all through my life. And he became... He started a liberal, but then he became very socialist, and then the socialists ran into communism, and then it went back to socialism. And it always used to annoy me rather, but I got on him reasonably well, but I wouldn't say that he was ever a great father to me.
Now, was his socialism, do you think, linked to his war services experiences?
No, I don't think so, no. I don't really know. I certainly don't think he was volunteered. He was called up. He was... Staff Sergeant Major in the Highland Light Infantry he finished up in, and I believe he was mentioned in dispatches, but only for probably administrative work. But his father was of that breed. He was the first socialist councillor in the suburb of Nottingham, Beeston and Stapleford in the early part of the century. And he, like a lot of them, they were pink, and then they got slowly redder, and of course when Russia came into the war they got very bright red because they were saving us.
Now, you mentioned you had three sisters.
Yeah.
Were they older than you?
They're all older than me, yes. My eldest sister was 10 years older than I was, and I suppose she looked after me as much as my mother did. The other two sisters, one was 7 years older and one was 3 years older.
And what were their names?
Nancy, Betty and Peggy.
Now, what kind of place was Leicester, the Leicester that you remembered growing up?
Well, I was only born in Leicester. I was only born in Leicester because it happened to have a very good nursing home at the time. And we came and lived in Nottingham in West Bridgeford from when I remember being born, 1922 to about 1926. Because I remember I went to school when I was four in West Bridgeford because they knew the teacher. And when we moved into Nottingham, they wouldn't let me go to school there until I was five, and we lived in the Forest Fields area prior to moving to Mapley about 1928, I think it was, 1928 or 1929, which of course is very near to where I live now. I went to school though at the same area in Forest Fields in Nottingham, the three schools, the infants, the junior school and the secondary school, as it was then, it became a grammar school. We're all on the same road, and I went from one side of the road to the other from 1927 to 1939. And although it was about, I think it must be 2.5 miles, 3 miles away from where I lived, I walked there every day and back. And if I had the odd halfpenny, I could get a bus halfway, but that was it. So I got some good walking in my time.
Now, was your father at all affected by the general strike? Would be something that you probably couldn't remember at all.
I do. I remember in 1926 when I lived in West Bridgeford, my father took me out onto Trump Boulevard and said, "Look, there's nothing on the roads." And I didn't say anything. He said that there's a strike on and there are no buses, there are no cars. And that was as much. He was very pleased, actually, I think. But, I do remember that, but that's about... I remember my first birthday, which a lot of people don't believe, but I certainly do remember it. I sat in a high chair and had my photograph taken, and I was taken by my sister to see this teacher of mine and handed from one to the other and then back again. And I remember being in a pram and smelling the wreck scene of the hood and taken down the Trent in a pushchair when I was about three. So I've got a long memory. And as I say, people don't believe me, but I do remember it quite clearly.
Would you say, looking back, that you had a comfortable childhood in terms of...
Oh, yes. Yes, very. I remember later on at school, when I was in the junior school, I suppose they call it, well, they did it then, I don't know what they call it now, but the teacher said that I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth, and I didn't know what the hell that meant. But apparently, talking to friends, and I have friends now who I went to school with when I was five, one of them I sat beside, I saw him yesterday, funny enough, and he said, I thought, yeah, this is rich, but of course we weren't. We had very little money at all, because when my father left home, as a way of trying to get back into my mother's good books, he decided to cut the money off. And I know she had to last on about, if he felt like giving her, about £2.10 a week in the old money. And she seemed to be forever in debt. Well, no, not in debt, but because she kept on the top of things. But he was very frugal, quite honestly. I mean, I remember she had to sell a whole room of furniture, hoping she'd get some money. And I think she got £1.10 for a whole room. So we had an empty sitting room for about 2 years. But so that was the way it was. Never had a very good childhood, really.
And you said your father was a commercial traveller. What did he actually do?
He travelled in calendars. And I don't quite... Calendars was the main thing. He worked for E&S and A. Robinson of Bristol, who were printers and calendar makers in the day. So, of course, he had a sort of a yearly job. He had to sell these calendars early on the year for the next year. And he had to do it fairly quickly, otherwise people had already bought them. And these are the days when firms did buy calendars, and I mean they made it quite a part of the business to attract their customers, I suppose.
And your father left home, so did your mother work at all?
No, she had been a teacher, but she didn't work. Of course, by the time that happened, my eldest sister was about 16, and she got a little job. No, she never did. She worked during the war, but that was only because, she had nobody to bother about then. Everybody left home, and she managed to get herself a job working for the government somewhere, or down south somewhere, but... No, she stayed at home and looked after us.
Now, you'd started school. What was your impression of school in terms of discipline and so on? Do you have any memories of?
In the infant school, it was very easy. I enjoyed it. I mean, well, in fact, you didn't expect anything other than to have to enjoy it, did you? My big memory, I suppose, is those days is watching the R101 fly over Nottingham. Prior to it crashing, and we were all taken out into the playground to see this wonder. And I then moved quite automatically over to the junior school, which was across the road. And being born on the 5th of August, it made me the wrong side of the year ending. I think the year ending used to be the 30th of July, so I always finished up either going the year before or holding back a year until my age came along. So I was at the junior school, I think, for 4 years instead of three, because I had to have an extra year. And that was quite... we had a very good cricket team there, and we won the Nottingham Cup that was put up at the time. It was the first time it had been... This was about 1937, I think. And again, a lot of the friends who were in the infant school moved over with me, so we carried on, as it were. I remember that the classes were 48. We had a headmaster, two male teachers, and a female. And you see, this was so funny now. I mean, these characters came into the classroom, the 48 children, they just said, be quiet, and everyone was. And The headmaster was very keen on spelling and writing, and whenever he came in the room would immediately start showing us how to do copperplate writing and spelling generally. And funny enough, the majority of people who went to that school, even today, are considered very good writers. We had, the sport of course was confined virtually to the playground. We had a master who stayed every lunchtime and played cricket with us, and with a trestle table, and gave us a penny if we were particularly good. And of course nowadays I suppose if a teacher did that they'd be brought up before the governor offering money to children. We used to play at the local recreation ground, the Forest, which is where the goose fair is held in Nottingham. And from there we had to take the annual general examination as to see whether you could go to a secondary school or a, I don't know what the hell they called them, senior school I suppose. And I remember I was top of the class for a couple of years, well the last 2 years, 41 out of 48. And then we went to High Pavement, which is the, which was a secondary school which became a grammar school, and of which, although it's defunct now, it was formed in 1788. We celebrated our 200th anniversary and then formed a society which I belong to and which is still active. That of course was, it was the it was the first school in Britain to teach science, and it was also run by a headmaster that tried to bring into it, or did bring into it, the house system, and treated it more as a public school than a secondary school. So we had various houses and house masters who all wore gowns, and through Chalkatcher.
Now,
and generally,
before we continue with that, you were selected to go to this school. Now, mm-hmm. About how many out of the class at the junior school were selected? You said there's a class of 48.
And I wouldn't think there were more than 20. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but I wouldn't think there were more than 20. I mean, we say we had good education, but of course, out of the 48, 8 of them are absolutely hopeless. And some of them, although I never see them, one or two have turned up even now, and they finished up as squadron leaders and God knows what. There were probably more, but roughly I would say there were more than a third of the 48.
What are the ones that didn't go?
They went to what were called senior school. I'm not quite sure what they did call them. But they were looked upon rather. we look rather down upon those sort of schools.
Now, at the time when you were preparing to either go or not to go to the senior school, were you and your friends at that time, was that something that you were worried about? Was it something that your parents were worried about?
The whole thing was you accepted that you did these exams and you just sort of expected to get through them, and if you didn't, it was no sort of detriment to you. The difference with going to the High Pavement was that if you didn't get a free scholarship, you had to pay fees, which was 3 guineas a term. And I remember having to take £1 on account and pay the rest in instalments. But I think the very fact that we knew we were having to, or your parents were having to pay your education, you weren't, I wouldn't say you were particularly conscious of it, but I think when you have to make a sacrifice to be educated, you do your best, put it that way.
Now, just on the same subject of school, was there kind of a dominant employer in the area?
Yeah.
You know, most children, what was the dominant employer?
Well, the dominant employer was Players, cigarette factory, and Raleigh, the bike firm, and Boots, of course, which is still in existence. Raleigh are, but they're falling about a bit. And there was a gun factory in Nottingham. There was plenty of employment, but unfortunately, and that's the big thing that was against the system in those days, they never told you what jobs there were available to you. They expected that people who went to secondary school went into either insurance or local government, or the civil service, or teaching. But of course, in those days, to teach, you had to go to university. And although we had a good record for people who went to university, there were very few and far between. And most people, of course, were anxious to leave to earn money, which seemed to be the dominant factor in those days. But they never gave us any advice or any ideas of what one would expect when you got outside.
And what were your favourite subjects at school?
My favourite subjects were geography, history, English, and I hadn't been at school a year before they decided that I should go into another science form when they dropped my favourite subjects and gave me maths, mechanics, physics and chemistry, and English, of course, and the rest of it. But it was rather strange, that was, because they didn't give you any choice. They said, next year, after the first year, which was a sort of general grading as far as they were concerned, they said, you'll go into that form and you'll go into that form. But they didn't ask you whether you wanted to or whether there was any reason why you shouldn't. So consequently, when it came to the exam, for instance, you started off by taking Latin and French for a year, and you expected to carry on taking that, but no, after the first year, they said, no, you'll take German, you'll drop French and you drop Latin, you'll take German and you'll drop geography and history, and you'll take chemistry and physics and mechanics and maths and English, which were normal. And that's what happened to you. That's what you did.
And did people just accept that? That was how things were. Now, you mentioned the dominant employers in the area. Mm. I mean, at this stage, you're 12, 13, that kind of age. What were your thoughts about your career? What career did you think you might like?
I had no idea at all. My father was hopeless in that respect. I mean, he never said anything. My mother, of course, wanted me to go into a bank, because that's clean, dear, and you mustn't come home from a factory looking dirty. And when I don't know whether it was prior to leaving school, I looked around for... Oh, I was offered jobs in banks, but I didn't like the idea, an insurance company. And I was looking through the paper and I found this city of Nottingham were offering jobs, the city treasurer's department, because of course in those days gas, electricity and water were run by the council corporation. And I applied for a job in the water office, because they were paying £52 a year, whereas the gas department were only paying 50. But you didn't just have a job in those days, you had to apply for it. You then had to go for an interview and had an exam and an oral interview, and you were then dispatched to the office to which you were sent, which in my case was the water office, on the 30th of March 1939.
Now that's moving us forward a little bit. So you didn't leave school at 14?
No.
Now, what about your classmates? Were there?
No, it was expected you stayed until you were 16 anyway.
And that wasn't a problem for anybody, because that time we've talked about how there's a big pressure to leave school at 14. So once you've got to this school...
Yeah, well, you had to sign at 16 to take the Oxford and Cambridge School certificate, or matriculation as it was then known.
Now, you've mentioned your father's interest in politics. First of all, was there any lessons of that kind at the school? Was there any kind of attempt to talk a bit about contemporary Britney? Was your father an influence at this stage as a young teenager?
Not really. It didn't influence me at all. In fact, it went over my head rather. All I knew was that he shopped at the co-op, because of course the co-op was socialist. And I had a cousin who was with the Nottingham co-op, who was also a socialist. He became a communist, and there was a tale once upon a time that the only way you got promotion in the Nottingham Co-operative Society was to be a communist, which was very true actually, but that's another story. But
did your mother share your father's political opinions?
No, she was a liberal, always been a liberal, dear, sort of thing, and thought Norman Burkitt and the ilk were the cream of the world. Yes, she always was a liberal. She'd been a suffragette in the early days of suffrage and had tomatoes thrown at her, she told me, on the Cart Forest. And she was a very independent feminist, I suppose you call her nowadays, but she always said that, well, she was very innocent and naive, I believe. I mean, she said, your father and I were great friends for many years, dear, and I expected that when we got married it would be the same. And of course, they weren't compatible. They were compatible as friends, but they weren't compatible as husband and wife, that way.
Now, just staying in this period, in the mid-30s, you were at school. Were you aware at all of the situation in Europe? I mean, specifically the Spanish Civil War?
Yes, I joined the Cubs and I joined the Scouts, and of course, you got patriotism drummed into you a little bit then. I remember being at the seaside with my father. It must have been 1933, because he said, you'll hear yaw coming over the channel from Germany. Of course, I couldn't understand what he meant, but that was, of course, Hitler, was fairly prominent in my mind. I've got diaries, in fact, that I kept in 1937, 1938, 1939, 1940. And I used to cut out press cuttings of the, what went on at the time, like the Spanish Civil War and anything that was of interest. And I kept quite a detailed diary, including the weather forecast and what time I went to bed. And they're quite interesting to read now, because but I don't think I put in personal observations of the politics, apart from the fact that either we weren't doing very well in the early days of the war, of which I kept quite a detailed account at the beginning of the war, from the day war broke out. But no, I didn't.
Was your father very vocal about this, things like the Civil War and Hitler? Did he talk about it?
He talked about that, of course, because obviously he was on the side of the Republicans. And as, in fact, I suppose, to a large extent, so was the rest of the country. I mean, the International Brigade, and then, of course, we had the Italian invasion of Abyssinia, and as it was then, which, of course, brought that to the fore, and Mussolini and the rest of them.
Was there anybody that you knew locally that went off to the International Brigade, or was there
there wasn't really. I certainly didn't know them, but I suppose there must have been.
So you left school at 16, got this job. What did your contemporaries do, your classmates?
I don't. One or two went to the Treasurer is with me. In fact, I still see one who was on the same sort of interview, but it wasn't. What happened then, of course, was that we got completely split up, because within 8 months of me leaving school, war had been declared. I remember meeting an old teacher in Nottingham who recently died, in probably the last 10 or 15 years. And he remembered me, and he said, you know, I always think of your generation, he said, because you're the ones that all went to war. And because of that, when we came on leave, we looked for people we knew, and we naturally looked for school friends. And consequently, with that continual meeting up, we've remained, many of us, I mean, remained friends right from the early school days right until today, because that was the only people you knew were people you'd known at school. So for 5 years you went to the nearest pub and looked around to see if there was anybody there, actually.
Now, was there any kind of cadet force or anything at the schools, any kind of
there was a scout group, there was a dramatic society of which I was used to take the feminine lead mostly, and there was a very good rugby team, and there was a very good cricket team, In fact, sports were they were excellent at. I remember playing rugby, and there was some German boys who'd come who were, I suppose, they were on. What the hell do you call it? A sort of
exchange
for a short time, and we used to pull his leg about Hitler and the rest of it. And when airplanes came over, you'd tell him he ought to duck, but we took it very lightheartedly.
And did he take it lightheartedly?
Yes, he did at the time. Yeah.
So at this stage, were you joking about it? But you were seeing, I suppose, it would be the First World War.
I think that I expected that there would be a war because it had been drummed into us right from early age. Comics in those days and books like Biggles and everything, the films were, the Dawn Patrol, you know, Errol Flynn, all that sort of rubbish. I say it was rubbish now, and it wasn't then because it was contemporary. All Quiet on the Western Front. I mean, although it's a wonderful film, and yet it didn't sort of fill us with horror. It was rather an exciting time to live through. In fact, I remember as a boy hoping to be a war, as long as I didn't get killed or wounded. But and it was expected. It was you didn't really think you were going to settle down to have a peaceful life for the rest of your life.
Had you given any thought to what arm of the armed forces you would want to be?
Well, if we go to the outbreak of war, and the day after the war broke out, a friend and I, he was a bit older than I was, went down to the recruiting office in King's Walk in Nottingham, to the naval recruiting office, and found it closed. And we thought, what a funny way to run a war. So we gave up that idea and decided we'd wait until something else happened. And that his father had been in the Navy, and at the Battle of Jutland, I believe, and we sort of got a bit naval focused and decided that surely was the thing, the service you should be in if you're British. And but he finished up in the Army, and so did I.
And what was his name?
It was a fellow called Joss Shelley. He's dead now, but he was a... Strange, that man, because the army didn't do much for him. He was quite an intelligent, quite well educated, and is artistic in a way. But he was in the Wavells lot in the Western Desert, and when he came back, he seemed to have I'm trying to think of the word. It had roughened him. And it's funny enough, he had a brother who was a real old yobbo by today's standards, and a bit of a tearaway. He joined the army, and it completely changed him into an upright, soldierly lad, young man, and who changed completely. He went sort of, he was killed in Normandy, strangely enough. The other one, I don't say it ruined him, but it didn't do him any good, his personality any good. But whereas his brother, who was, a rough diamond, the army changed him completely. I could hardly recognise him as the same person. But what were you saying?